Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another exciting edition of Monday Motivation. Hi everyone, this is Rabbi Garfinkel of Olami 613 Chicago with a live studio audience. Woo! Yes, hope that wakes you up on your commute or in your workout. Thank you to the live studio audience. And we have a very special Monday Motivation today, which is going to mostly be the audio recording of the Mensch of the Month. We have an incredible series of the Mensch of the Month where we highlight an Olami 613 participant who has been involved. They're all fascinating and all available on YouTube. And I will make sure that the link to the video that Rabbi Marcus, who needs a big shout out, deserves a big shout out for all of his incredible editing. So it's definitely worthwhile as well, in addition to check out the video version. But the audio in of itself speaks volumes. You know, and we're going to come back to that in a moment. I just want to say one quick thing here that today I'm recording this April 26th, and this podcast will drop April 27th, but it is my birthday, April 26th, and I want to take this opportunity to thank my parents for bringing me into this world, for raising me. I want to thank my whole family for supporting me in all these endeavors of Olami 613, Jewish outreach. Particular, my wife Suri, who does not get nearly enough credit for the incredible job that she does working with these Jewish young professional women, as well as all of the incredible, we say, hachnasat orchim, hosting of the guests in our home downtown. Just words can't really describe how much she does. And so, if you're listening, shoot Suri a text. That'll be one of my birthday gifts. The other birthday gift that I would love is for people to do something more in Judaism, to either learn more, take on a little project, sign up for, I don't know, Partners in Torah if you're a young professional, women, you do the SOLD program. If you're a young professional listening, we also have a mentorship program that we're starting a new cohort. Or just reach out, hey, Rabbi, I want to come for Shabbos. That would be the greatest gift that you could give me, that our efforts here are inspiring you. And circling back now to the Mensch of the Month, this is why I love this series so much. Because when you hear how special, how much talent this young generation has, and if they were only be given the Jewish tools to be able to use those skills for the Jewish people and the world, it's all we need to do. It's all we need to do. Because if we don't, then all that talent will be lost to the Jewish people and sadly probably lost to the world as well. And so when I hear quotes from this Mensch of the Month, quotes like, I had always had a burning need to figure out who I am, and Olami helped me feel like I finally came home. That makes this whole endeavor worth it. He also said, it's a testament to the power of Judaism that the Russians and Germans tried to take Judaism away from me, but it's still in me. You can't take away a Jewish soul. This is an absolutely fantastic person. Absolutely fascinating story from Stalin to satellites. Mensch of the Month, Michael Mont. Enjoy and please share with others. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome the very next Mensch of the Month. Sitting right next to me here is our dear, amazing, wonderful participant for many years. Give it up for Michael Mont. Michael, thank you so much for being here.
for making time. And really,
this is very well earned.
Thank you. Glad to be here and excited to walk through my story.
Amazing. Well, we can't wait. And you have been a dedicated Olame 613, and even before that, Project 613, and then we'll even get to a previous iteration of when?
2015.
Unbelievable.
DePaul University.
Many years of connection, and you bring such goodness with you, and it's really a pleasure. So Mazel Tov on your Mensch of the Month.
Thank you.
All right, so let's dive in over here. Michael, tell us about yourself. Tell us about your family background, where you're from, where you're born, etc.
I was born in Ukraine in a city called Kharkov. It's on the eastern side, kind of like their version of Detroit. Well, actually, Detroit and Huntsville, Alabama. It's famous for heavy machinery exports and then rockets and airplane manufacturing. So we'll get to that later, but it's a great legacy city to be from. And I was born there, moved here when I was two, Chicago lifer. And I think in a lot of ways, I have a very typical Russian Jewish family story. I grew up knowing that I'm Jewish. And I think the most Jewish trait about my childhood is that I always questioned what that meant because I had no clue, right?
My Jews family always ask questions, right?
Right. And in my heart, I have a Jewish soul. I always knew I was, I was a Jew, but I had no clue. We didn't do the holidays. I think the biggest family holiday was when my grandma made matzo ball soup, and that was the holiday. And then we would recite some, conglomeration of both Passover and Hanukkah, and it was vaguely in December. I don't know. Like, that's the extent of my Jewish upbringing.
So high holidays or Passover, Hanukkah, something of those?
Yeah, Passover and Hanukkah we would do, but okay. We never had a Seder. We didn't understand
You have Jewish friends growing up?
No Jewish friends until I met my best friend, Jacob, in sixth grade. But even then, we didn't do anything Jewish. We went to a very non-Jewish school. And it wasn't until after college, when I really started diving into my Jewish story, that I understood the culture where I'm from. That being said, my family's story is extremely Jewish. My great-grandma, Chaya, on my grandma's side, was... one of 13.
One of 13?
Yeah, one of 13. Her mother actually had an order from the Soviet Union for being a very good mom.
Really?
Yeah. The Soviets ignored her Jewishness and still gave her an award. And, a lot of them, the Shoah and World War II kind of broke everyone up. And the survivors didn't really talk. My mom was actually born in Tallinn in Estonia, where I have a lot of family roots, which is in the Baltic area. And then further back on my mom's side, they were... rabbis in St. Petersburg. They were one of the first, because the Pale, we weren't allowed in St. Petersburg until the 1890s.
There's certain areas called the Pale of Settlement. You can look it up, but Jews were only allowed to live within certain areas and many times not in the big fancy cities.
Yes.
Michael, let me just jump in here for a second. So come to America and your family has some vague memory of Judaism and doing something, but you come from a line of distinguished rabbis. What's going on over here?
It's both the pain and the miracle of the 20th century. And I grew up loving history. My grandpa on my mom's side was a Soviet fighter pilot, one of the few Jews allowed to fight. My dad's side, my grandparents were both engineers. And these are very, as far as Jews could go in the Soviet Union, very respectable careers. And so I grew up, loving anything that moves and then learning a lot about history, but like a very secular, whitewashed version of history. And the Soviets did a really good job submitting every Jew into fear, right? I barely knew what that meant. I knew that we were Jewish, but, I'm the result of the third generation of being stripped away from access to Jewish education.
So basically, if anyone showed outward religiosity in the Soviet Union, it was fear of exile, death, penalty.
My mom has memories right after the fall of the Soviet Union, so a couple of years before I was born, of hosting a rabbi at their home in Kharkov in early 90s Ukraine, and her being shocked that he ate all this canned food because she didn't understand. They try to offer him like pork sausage, and she's like, no. And none of it. They didn't even understand the cultural power, or they didn't have a cultural memory of what that meant. I know that there were networks, in the 70s to you know, the first wave of Jewish emigration. But my family was afraid of that. And it's actually, there's an inverse correlation. All the Jews who were very heavily prosecuted in the 20th century, in the beginning of it, ended up in America. They had a century-long head start on having a better life. My family was too comfortable. And it's not a good type of comfort. You know, comfortable is very relative. We had enough to eat for a couple months, so we decided to stay for about 80 years, too long.
You know, Michael, it's amazing you say that, because I always joke that Ashkenazi Jews, you know, we are all Russian Jews. Just depends when we came, right? So yep. My great-grandfather was killed in a pogrom in 1906 by Tsar Nicholas, and his widow took four young Garfinkel boys through Ellis Island, and that was our story. And it's just amazing. We were from the same Ukraine and just at a different point of history when the anti-Semitism was able to play its way out.
It's politically contentious to say this, but you touched it. Russian Jew, right? I'm born in Ukraine. My first language is Russian. I don't know a single word of Ukrainian. And it's very difficult trying to nuance the identity of all those countries. The borders change every 80 or so years. You know, there are a lot of people that will probably be like, I'm a Moldovan Jew or a Ukrainian Jew or a Lithuanian Jew. You know, I'm a Jew. Everything else is because for so long we were excluded. So, yeah, I'm a firm believer that the only, you know, I'm a Jew who happens to speak Russian from.
Well, it's an amazing testament
there
to your family, to its dedication that you're the surviving ember and coming back to life. So I want to dig in one more thing in terms of your family past, which is absolutely fascinating, that blew Rabbi Marcus and I away, okay? And then I want to discuss what got you excited to get involved in Jewish things today. Tell us about your very famous ancestor and the books.
I think the story sequentially starts with the books, right? My dad had these two books that, you know, are called Shem Tov, that were written by my great-grandfather. He was a Talmudic scholar in the early 1910s, right before the Russian Revolution. And my dad had two surviving copies of his books that he rebound. And my dad also doesn't read any Hebrew, didn't really understand what they meant. So one day I bring them to one of your classes, and it was after class. I remember I was just like, hey, I have these like two things from my family. Do you want
to? But they knew to take them from
yeah,
Russia.
They knew to.
These
yeah.
were important things.
Yes. Like I said, we were all born with a Jewish soul, right? Something in us captivated us to keep these two books. We, you know, for about 80 years, we haven't been able to read them.
This is your great-grandfather?
Yeah.
And he wrote these amazing books. By the way, he wrote more than those two books. And Rabbi Marcus and I, when we got it, just to our end of the story, we got these books, we started looking at them. And right away, you could tell this was a major Jewish scholar. And when we looked up online, he wrote many other books as well. And what blew us away is that on the title page of the Shem Tov, which is one of the names of one of the books, he writes, he is of the descendants from his mother's side of the great genius, Rav Chaim Volozhin. Now, Rav Chaim Volozhin, so when Rabbi Marcus and I saw this, we just exploded. It was like, I was trying to, you know, in secular terms, if like someone finds out, oh yeah, you know, Michael Jordan's my dad, you know, or, you know, I'm related to, you know, fill in the blank of a icon. You know, I hate to, you know, compare that because obviously one is holy and one is just a basketball player. But your great-grandfather and up to Rav Chaim Volozhin was the founder of the modern yeshiva movement. Any yeshiva bachur a couple hundred years ago basically would just live in the basement of somehow. He had to like scrounge for food. And your ancestor said, no, that's not the way it should be. He actually made it appropriate and fitting that yeshiva students shouldn't grovel for their food. They should have food every day. And he built a beautiful building. And every yeshiva basically now on planet Earth can give credit to your ancestor for having come up with this remarkable idea.
You know, it's funny. I actually just realized this. That's my dad's side. And my mom's side are all teachers, which is like an extension, you know. And I actually wanted to be a teacher growing up. But I think the most important part of that story is how it makes me feel, right? I had a split identity growing up. I am American first, and I'm very proud to be American, but I'm not your typical American. And then I thought I was Russian, but I'm not really Russian. Like, I don't caucus there. Like, I mean, I speak the language. I definitely like some of the accomplishments they've done with technology, but as for everything else, absolutely not. And I always had this, like, weird, you know, like, who am I? What am I? Like, where do I come from? And that book and that story and the resources that OLMU gave me to study it are very important in making me feel like I finally came home. And I think that it is a testament to the power of Judaism that, you know, the most vile and destructive forces of the 20th century tried to take it away from me. You know, the Germans, the Russians, all of it, they tried. If it wasn't for these two books, I would have no physical proof of who I, you know, of my family lineage. But it's still in me. You can't take away, you know, a Jewish soul. And, like, I always had this, like, burning, you know, need to figure out who I am and what that meant. And I think those books are the long start of a hate to use the word, like, journey of satiation. You know, like, I finally feel satiated because I no longer have that question of, you know, my purpose and, you know, where I come from.
Amazing. So let's dig in. Michael, I'm, like, totally inspired. I mean, you always inspire me, but just to hear it is very powerful. Yeah. Tell us briefly. We met at DePaul, and then fast forward to Jacob Custer, shout out, our inaugural Mentor of the Month, brought you to, at that time, Project 613. Give us a little bit of your Jewish background and how your that thirst was quenched.
Yeah, at DePaul, I was in AEPI, which is a great organization for young men and sort of a very 40,000-foot view of reconnecting with your Judaism. But I then I wanted to learn a lot more. And I graduated undergrad, spent a couple years kind of just floating. and then my best friend is like, come to these Jewish events. And I had a, you know, it's like, right, sure, I'll go to one. And then, I went to two, and then I went to three. I kind of came home, I guess, right? I think that's the best and most succinct way to put that.
Amazing. And, you know, a lot of it, I think, is Judaism, but a lot of it, I think, is personality. And we clicked, and Rabbi Marcus and Jacob, and we'll include India in that group of people that really, a lot of reconnecting to Judaism is having a friend group that says, it's cool to do this.
More than just it's cool, it's a better level of connection because, you know, I started going here before October 7th, but I think for a lot of people of my generation, I mean, of every Jewish generation, especially mine, the world became black and white after that event. And there are people who understand it, and there are people who don't. And 90% of my friends in my old social life just do not understand, right? And they never will, and I don't blame them for it. But it's very nice to be with people who understand. And I had this whole part of my background and identity that I never explored or understood. And yeah, it allowed me to, you know, it's very nice to hang out with people who have the same values, who have the same ambition, who have the same dreams of, you know, what their future might look like.
And let's dig in just to a couple of the programs, because you've done a lot of our program, our weekly learning program, Shabbos in the Hood at our home, Rabbi Marcus's home, as well as Shabbos in the city. And highlight maybe a couple of the trips that you've done. Right? We've done both Morocco and Israel.
Well, even before then, I had started with a weekly learning, which was very good to get a baseline understanding of, you know, being Jewish. And then about a month in, I went to the Shar, right?
Yes, the Shar.
In five towns.
Yes, in Far Rockaway. Shar is an amazing, it's Olami's basically introductory yeshiva, where people could go and just explore their Judaism.
That trip was a vibe. It was an interesting one because they had one of my great-grandpa's books in the library. I remember exploring that, and that was very cool.
Right, we went with the Rosh Hashiva.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah, so I really enjoyed that trip. That was a good course correction. Then I went to Morocco. Morocco was actually a very good trip. You know, it was just good to see non-Ashkenazi Jewish history. I guess growing up, I was very Ashkenazi, I now realize. I barely knew the other strands of Judaism. I definitely did not know anything about Mizrahi Jews or Sephardic Jews or the fact that there's such a diverse diaspora. And Morocco was a really good dive into this whole other side of Jewish history and Jewish pride. I still think about the story of Sol. That was a very, you know, visiting her grave.
Yes.
And that was a very inspirational moment. It's a very different type of persecution than the one I grew up reading about. I mean, it's still Jewish. It's still a very Jewish story.
This is a famous Moroccan woman who gave up her life for refusing to marry someone of royalty, right, who was not Jewish. And she was that dedicated to Judaism and is really very powerful in Moroccan Jewish tradition and really had a deep impact on our group.
And I think that what these trips really teach you is this really good sense of fearlessness about both learning to embrace and practice Judaism and then just being Jewish. Because growing up, I was an immigrant, so I just wanted to fit in. So I wanted to strip away a lot of stuff. Now, I never wanted to be less Jewish, but I wanted to be like a American Jew. I mean, I wanted to be what, Adam Sandler, I guess? That was like my benchmark. Like, it wasn't a particularly inspirational benchmark, but that's what I saw and that's what I wanted to be. And the trips, you know, the resilience of our people and the trials and tribulations that they go through and still survive really put your own life into context. So, yeah, they do a very good job putting context around Judaism, and they do, I think, a good job enabling me to just let go of the what ifs. Like, I'm just gonna go try this because what's my excuse? You know, I'm not being persecuted in the moment. I live in a free society. I can just go ahead and be Jewish. And
amazing.
Nothing's gonna happen.
Amazing. Okay, Michael, we've done Jewish identity, and now I want to pivot. You have a very interesting career. You're building something amazing in terms of your a new company that you're building. And in addition, I want to hear not just the technical parts of it, but what is your Jewish learning? What is your Jewish experiences with us and in your Jewish growth? How does that impact you in the business world?
So I, for about 8 years, have worked at a private equity fund that invests in rail cars, containers, and aircraft. Like I said earlier in the story, I come from a long line of engineers and pilots and just people who like anything mechanical. And I grew up, my grandpa would walk me sort of down the streets in America, and none of my family spoke English. So the only thing that they could identify were like the logos on the cars. So he'd point and be like, Toyota. And I would be like, great. It's a 1992 Toyota Corolla. And I grew up loving cars, like anything mechanical. So my career was an extension of roughly that. I started on the rail side, learning how to invest in rail cars. Then it evolved into emerging technology. And then I developed a thesis on how to finance the construction, how to finance and lease space infrastructure. So satellites, rockets.
So for novices antennas. Like me, this is like Avis rent a car for satellites. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, the best,
something like that?
Kind of, yeah.
Hertz rent a satellite.
Or like, here, did you know that most airlines don't own their aircraft? Like,
I had absolutely no idea. No.
Yeah, okay. Most airlines lease an aircraft. Like a Boeing 737 lasts about 25 to 35 years. And the first owner is very different than the third owner of a Boeing 737. So United will lease it, then it'll move on, you know, and be leased by someone else. For a long time, satellites and ground stations and all other space infrastructure was very tailored to the first person. So there was no way to lease it out. And the problem when you have to buy everything up front is that it really limits who can buy it. So I developed a creative way to explain to, you know, investors like the world that I come from and lenders and even the people who operate these assets that, hey, you can in fact lease this, which both reduces the cost and grows the total amount of people who invest into space. And the reason I wanted to bring it up here is that, you know, it is extremely hard to, one, develop an investment thesis, but even harder to have the gumption to just pitch it to the company that you work at, like to the founder, to the CEO. I got a lot of the inspiration and conviction through Jewish learning, because you know, the world in which I work in, I have a lot of exposure to very, you know, ultra high net worth individuals, people who grew up with every advantage in the world. And, you know, I went to college on a Pell Grant. Like, I learned all of this myself, everything from how to invest to how to model, et cetera. Like, didn't really have much guidance in my family on how to do this. And so the one thing that gave me the conviction and confidence to go ahead and develop this and pitch it is really Jewish study. You know, one, I love the way that the Talmud is written. I think that is the most Jewish thing, right? That you have a 4,000 or 5,000 year old kind of, I call it a moral code. I know that the Torah is much more, but it's a code, right? And it's been refined through the centuries by different people and their ways of thinking. That is not too different from anyone who's very good at their job, right? You have to have a lot of different opinions. You have to learn how to condense them into something actionable and pitch it and explain it to the layperson. And it is almost insulting to the idea that I'm a Jew and that I come from, you know, a line of Talmudic scholars, that I can't figure out how to pitch, like, buying a rocket or something. And I think that is really the power, that is the power of Jewish study, that if you don't have, you know, our faith and our background, you are intimidated by these earthly things, right? You are intimidated by things like your career or what happens next. But I know that I have, you know, a much bigger purpose. And the contextualization of studying Talmud, of learning how to read it, of learning how to interpret it, really puts in a context that, like, it's just a job, right? You know, it is just a pitch. It is just a thesis. It is just an analysis. And, you know, if my ancestors could write that, if they could figure out how to, you know, parchment was very expensive. You couldn't have the luxury in an agrarian society to reflect on the state of the world. And yet I come from a line of people who did. So if I come from a background like that, then why am I intimidated by, you know, like staying a couple extra hours and figuring out how to do something? And so
it's amazing. It's both the process of what your ancestors did that inspired you and the content of that you have faith. There's an almighty. And now let's just maybe make it full circle. You grew up, you know, in the atheist Soviet Union. Let's give a 30 seconds to the almighty and how that has maybe been part of this equation.
Definitely. You know, I started, you guys got me to do tefillin a couple years ago, which is, I started rapping tefillin, on big pitch days for work, because, like, it just calmed me down. Like, it really supercharges your ability to execute on goals and ideas and processes. You know, I found that my faith keeps me grounded. It really it gives me the superpower to just kind of punch above my weight. And, you know, I alluded to it earlier, right? My competition is typically more well-resourced than I am. So how do I fight, you know, like, what gives me edge in a pitch, in the development of an idea, in, you know, claiming that I can execute despite having, you know, I'm young. I can't get away from the fact that you have to have age to have a track record, and I'm banking on the idea that I can do something, you know, because investors, anyone who wants to work with you wants to see a track record. So faith is the only thing that I have that can go against it. And it is very powerful in terms of, you know, giving you this ability to build and do.
So we're going to call this the modern day investor David and Goliath story. This is it. The young Turk, I should call you a Turk, the young Yid, the young Jew coming against all the other competition and having that faith in the Almighty, and therefore
not to caveat, I'm still in the middle of... you know, building my ideas. So the final chapter, no one knows. But
which makes this interview even more powerful, that you're all in with your faith with the Almighty. And now, before you know the final result, because that's really what faith is. So this is they're going to look back at this interview. It's like, wow, he had this faith now. That's really very special.
And faith builds into conviction. It builds into your ability to know, faith is the reason that I have confidence that my word means something, even though I haven't yet done it, you know? And, yeah, that's very important.
The word for faith is emunah, and it's inextricably linked with the word ne'eman, which is trustworthy. If you're trustworthy, if you believe in Hashem and you believe that He's going to come through for you, then you, by definition, are a trustworthy person. That currency flows through you in both directions. Okay, now, Michael, bringing it in for a landing. Very important question, okay? Eligible, single, are you taken? What's going on? All the ladies out there, they want to know. Young entrepreneur.
I will leave it. I've wanted to say this on a podcast for like a while now, but it is much easier, like much, much easier from experience to try and build a $1 billion company than to find a Jewish woman. So I will leave it at that.
Michael, if there's one thing that we would like to prove you wrong, okay, on this podcast or this Mensch of the Month, is that point. God willing, Hashem will send the right person at the right time. The right point of your development. And ladies, contact me, okay? Oh, can I be your shotgun? Can I be your, filter
gladly.
Through me.
What's the shotgun fee?
Shotgun, we'll discuss. It's the name on our new downtown building.
No,
How's that?
I put it in space. You ever, the Olami?
Oh, yeah. We can have Olami in space. Well, Olam means world, worldwide. Maybe it's above the world. That's great.
Yeah, there you go. Dream big.
Well, Michael, you bring your rabbis a lot of nachas. We're super proud of you. And I think even more importantly, Hashem is proud of you. Your ancestors are looking down. They're like, wow, is our descendant going to make it? And you've made it, and you're making it, and you're continue to grow. Yeah. May Hashem continue to bless you, both in the physical realm and the spiritual realm. And we look forward to having your family over, you and your wife and all your 10 kids. Okay. God bless. Yeah. Thank you. Mazel tov.
We want to wish... again, a huge mazel tov to Michael Mont on his well-deserved Mensch of the Month. I think you all can see the incredible Jewish young professionals that we have involved. And God willing, we will continue our efforts to inspire the next generation of Jews and Jewish leaders. And until then, God willing, we will see you again right back here next week for another exciting edition of Monday Motivation.